Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly, very professional libertarian podcast from the magazine of free minds and free markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy Juneteenth and summer solstice, freedom and sunlight lovers.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
We're going to talk about Joe Biden's real and metaphorical bicycle here in a moment. But first, even top shelf health insurance policies, that's totally a thing, typically do not cover the cost of being airlifted to a medical facility during an emergency. That's the reason for the season for the Air Medcare Network. When you join the Air Medcare Network, if you find yourself in need of medical air transport, you will not see a bill when flown by a participating AMCN provider. This peace of mind for your entire household can be yours beginning at the low, low price of $85 a year. AMCN helps transport more than 100,000 patients per year. That means around 30 per average Major League Baseball game, Catherine. Those of you Reason Roundtable listeners who sign up for that protection right now will receive a gift card from Visa or Amazon worth up to $50. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON and get you some of that peace of mind for your whole family. Please visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Joe Biden biffed on his bike this weekend in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. What is with you East Coast beach names? The Septuagenarian president.
Did you ever read the Bible, Matt Welch?
Nope. Slow motion tip over was a bit too on the nose, metaphorically. Catherine, I got that right, right? As the nation watches its chief executive just kind of stumble around as gas prices rise, inflation spikes, and the stock market does Pride Month and goes bare. Biden's approval ratings and even the desire among Democrats to have him run for re-election are in free fall. Meanwhile, fellow old politicians like Hillary Clinton are warning apocalyptically that with Republicans ready to seize power in November, this could be the last free election as we know it. Cheery stuff all around. Suderman, I would like to go to you first as a way of teasing without spelling out an exciting announcement we have about you at the end of the podcast. Let's whet appetites by having you start us go round the table and talking about some recent statements or actions by President Joseph Robinette Biden and his team that indicate a presidency perhaps slowly tipping over on a weirdly biblically named beach in Delaware.
So last week, Biden tweeted out that under my predecessor, the deficit rose every single year he was in the office. Under my plan, we're on track to cut the deficit by $1.7 trillion this year, the largest decline in American history. And so this is Biden's claim that he is, that because of what he is doing, the deficit is coming down. And this is in part a response to rising inflation, that he is, because inflation is rising, he is cutting the deficit because of his plan. And I think those are the key words to focus in on here. So I think the best way to understand Biden's claim here is that it's not a gimmick. And it's not really a lie either. It's not smoke and mirrors in the kind of Obamacare clever budgeting sense. It's just bullshit. Just complete bullshit. And I want to actually define bullshit here before we go any further, because there was a book back in 2005 by, I believe, a Princeton professor who titled On Bullshit. And this was a New York Times bestseller. And he starts with this whole sort of like investigation into the history of the word and what it means and how we use it all the time. And he comes to realize we don't really have a common understanding of bullshit. It means a whole bunch of different things. And what he eventually arrives on is that bullshit is actually best understood as a synonym for the old word humbug. Deceptive misrepresentation, short of lying, especially by pretentious word or deed of somebody's own thoughts, feelings, or attitudes. Yeah, that's what this is. So Biden is saying that the deficit is coming down because of his plan, but virtually all of the deficit reduction is because of the expiration, the planned expiration of COVID spending. It's not because of the stuff that Biden planned to do in a real sense or wanted to do. Instead, it's because all of that money that we spent, the temporary relief for COVID, all of that, that the trillions and trillions of dollars, much of which was passed under Trump, some of which was passed at the beginning of Biden's presidency, a lot of that was temporary spending. It was pitched as temporary spending. And now it's ending. And so Biden is just saying, well, that's what I'm doing here. And in fact, if you look at Biden's plans, if you look at what he wants to do and also what he has done, and then you compare it to the CBO baseline without his plans, sort of what would have happened in the absence of Biden's agenda, what you see is that Biden's plans have actually driven up the expectations for the deficit, for the annual deficit, which is, of course, the gap between spending and revenue for the federal government each year. And so in no real sense is Biden actually bringing down the deficit. And the better argument is that over the next decade, his policies and his plans either would, if he gets his way for things that haven't been passed yet, or already will because of stuff that has passed, like the infrastructure bill and like the $2 trillion in spending that he did with the Democratic Congress in January, right when he started. That stuff is all going to contribute to higher deficits in the long run. And yet he's claiming that he's out here being a deficit hawk, and he's just not.
That calls to mind, Catherine, that in a speech last week at the AFL-CIO, which I will be talking about a little bit later, President Biden said, now, not only is it infrastructure week, we've arrived at infrastructure decade. And then in parentheses, it said applause because it's the White House transcript. Catherine, I know that you have meticulously prepared some policy or statement by Biden and the White House over the past week or so that is particularly stumble bunny-ish. But I just wanted to trigger you with another line from that speech because it made me think of you for some reason. When I think global warming, I think jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Good paying union jobs. Jobs you can raise a family on. Jobs you can't outsource, be outsourced. So that's a TF to you.
Was he saying that when he fell over on his bicycle, Matt?
Yes. He was,
that would explain
he was mentally picturing it ahead of time.
He could hear the wheels of his bikes and they were saying jobs, 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 jobs. No, this obviously is always insane. The green jobs idea that we will slow down our economy and put a bunch of additional regulations and somehow, jobs. And like Nancy Pelosi, I primarily associate with that triple jobs. That was her kind of patented move. So I'm sorry to hear that it's infected Joe Biden. The thing I want to contribute on the bike discourse is that I Googled to find the video earlier because I want to watch it and enjoy it. And I found a little write-up that was all the different times that different presidents have fallen off bikes in recent memory, which God bless the internet. And it's so on brand. So Biden falling off his bike in Delaware, just already very good. 2004, George W. Bush took a spill while mountain biking on his ranch in Crawford. And more importantly, 2015, John Kerry, then Secretary of State, broke his leg while biking in the French Alps. Just incredible. Just
jobs,
everyone
jobs,
being themselves.
Didn't William Howard Taft fall off a penny farthing and crush a group of school children?
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly
In Cincinnati,
well.
Ohio. Yeah.
Have any of them fallen off a Peloton?
I mean, I one time tried to get on a Peloton and immediately fell off it. So that counts. The other thing I found while doing this Google was a result for something that was from March, where the Biden administration made it cheaper to buy kids' bikes from China by reinstating expired product exclusions from the big stupid tariff on China that we've been squabbling over for ages. And that is also my well-prepared answer to your question. I'll just do the short version, which is that Biden could do the thing he was supposed to be talking about when he fell off his bike, which was talk with China about reinstating a bunch of product exclusions from our tariffs with them in an effort to make some American customers experience cheaper products. Because as we recall, tariffs are not taxes on China. Tariffs are taxes on American consumers. Bikes are one of the things subject to those tariffs. So we should all be able to fall off bikes, just like the president.
Nick, help us through the bike discourse. What is a way in which Joe Biden has not been steering straight through these through the rough shoals.
Damn it, Matt. Now I'm just seeing red.
Oh, it's not, there are no shoals on a bike path. God damn it.
You have been to Rehoboth like I have.
Shoals of a deep sea bike path.
I have. I recommended that you go there.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Rehoboth. Rehoboth is the Jersey Shore without the charm. And with that,
you're
snooki,
so wrong. I will be missing the podcast higher, in 3 weeks to go there.
It's got a higher class of STDs. I get it, but it's just not so good.
I will give you that the pizza is some of the worst pizza I've ever eaten.
And
in my
it's
life.
Impossible to get to. It's a mediocre beach. It's not terrible, but it takes forever to get there, no matter where you are coming from. How long will it take you to get there, Catherine, from Washington, D.C.? Somewhere between two and 4 hours.
Yeah, right? That's an appropriate amount of time to get to a beach. No. Why are you being a hater?
No, because like I live a subway ride away and a ferry ride away from actual beaches that are beautiful.
You lived in Ohio for the last 20 years.
I know.
Like,
I'm back, you know? Yeah. I mean, Ohio doesn't have a beach. That's the point.
Did you want to answer the question, Nick?
No, Matt, I'm obviously. I'm waiting for the first unicyclist president and see how they fall. Will they fall
forward
or backward?
That's going to be an LP.
That's Beto O'Rourke.
That is an LP candidate, if ever I saw one.
Yeah, Beto O'Rourke might be doing that, although he might be still hanging on to the, whatchamacallit, the senior moment, Matt Welch. What was John Kennedy Jr.? Rollerblades. Thank you. He would be doing retro rollerblades, I think, ironically.
If we just skip to a Gen Z president, they might be riding a tricycle.
Yeah, that's true. Or, well, no, they'll be riding in the basket of their parents' tricycle in the back, you know, if we're Gen Z. Come on. So
I hope there's some electric charging stations for those.
About 3 weeks ago in a Wall Street Journal op-ed that, like the bike incident, really didn't provoke a lot of interest from, you know, the lumpen, you know, proletariat. And I find that actually one of the most interesting things about the bike fall is that, you know, when you compare it to something like, you know, Jimmy Carter collapsing, you know, during a fun run or getting beaten up by a killer rabbit on a boat, there just isn't the media anymore to really push this on everybody, whether or not you want it. I mean, obviously, Biden haters are, you know, have the bike collapse in heavy rotation, but it's kind of interesting. But his Wall Street Journal op-ed about how he's going to fight inflation, number one in that was saying that he was going to, his main contribution to inflation was to let the Fed do its job, number one, which is to fight inflation. And there, I think he's trying to signal that, like, when the Fed starts jacking up rates, and they have done that recently, they put it up, they put up their rate, the Fed rate by 0.75 points, which is the biggest increase in, you know, the past 20 years or something like that. He is trying to signal a la Reagan that he's going to go along with the Fed hiking rates in order to reduce inflation. Part of the problem with that is that along that way, everything goes up, both what the government is going to be spending on interest to service the debt. We're already going to spend like $400 billion this year on financing the debt, which is like half of the defense budget, which is a massive amount of money and will only go up if interest rates continue to go up. But we're also already seeing mortgage rates that are over 5%, which is the first time in a very long time. And that's going to freak people out, as well as all like credit card rates, all of that kind of stuff. And then finally, though, the thing is like the Fed helped to kill inflation in the 80s, in the late 70s and early 80s, by jacking its rate up to 20%. And there's just no way that Biden can let that happen. So he's lying when he says he's going to let the Fed do the job that it's supposed to do, which it also may not be able to do that effectively anyway. So I think that's one of the things to keep in mind. What is probably going to happen is that sometime between now and, you know, the midterm elections, and certainly before 2024, we're going to have a significant recession that everybody admits is a recession. And that's what's going to kill inflation for the time being.
It's at least theoretically possible that we are in a recession already, because you don't know until it's a two consecutive quarters of negative growth is the technical term, but you don't know what the growth is until sort of the after action report for each quarter. And so it takes some time to determine if you are actually already in a recession. And
it's
there
just
are
like a
indicators.
Pregnancy test.
Well, you can't tell if you're pregnant until the birth, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
so,
it's a lagging
right,
indicator.
So when you're pregnant, you have to go see what the Fed's going to say the next day. It's the
yeah.
So
I like to.
You can Fed shop.
Someone is very interested
and
in
Fed
that.
The abortion position, Matt. Come on.
Okay. I just wanted you to say it. Speaking of,
but
lying,
you can Fed shop. I like the Cleveland Fed. You know, for all my Fed needs.
I'm a St. Louis.
Some people
Fed.
Like St. Louis. Yeah, no, St. Louis
St.
is
Louis.
Very nice.
They have
a great
the best
database.
Reports.
Yeah.
Sexy, sexy reports.
You know, and St. Louis, you think sexy, right? So they're totally on brand.
Always.
Every time. As Nick, you mentioned Biden lying. I think that it's worth remembering.
You know, he's
that
the biggest liar in American politics since Ted Cruz.
I'm not
Lion
sure
Ted,
I'm ready to crown the victor in this. But I will point out that in the speech he gave last week to the AFL-CIO, he said such untruths as, I'm doing everything in my power to blunt Putin's gas price hike. Just since he's invaded Ukraine, it's gone up $1.74 a gallon because of nothing else but that. Dude, try harder.
Yeah.
You got to try harder with the lies. There's no such thing in the
world. I don't know if he does,
that,
because nobody's listening, though, right? I mean, that's the difference. Because, yeah, he also didn't mention the 50% increase in federal outlays between 2019 and 2021. You know, we went from $4.4 trillion a year to $6.8 trillion a year in a very compressed time frame. On the fiscal side, hey, that's going to cause inflation, which is exactly what happened.
I mean, this is something that's worth talking about just a little bit, is that the press is covering President Biden differently, not only than Donald Trump, but I think than previous sort of more normal presidents. And in particular, like you, the point that you made, Nick, that nobody's listening, is Biden is saying stuff that in a normal presidency would get a bunch of coverage and interrogation, especially in a Republican presidency. And if you remember, in, you know, when George W. Bush was president, like Slate had a running feature by one of their top editors called Bushisms. It just sort of popped up often a couple of times a month, right, when it was like Bush would have some sort of verbal slip up. And he did. He was not always a great speaker, especially in his second term, and sort of sometimes seemed confused about things and had all of these malapropisms. And I don't even necessarily, I'm not saying that that was illegitimate, but there is something a little bit at least notable happening where those we are seeing similar sorts of malapropisms, awkward at best arguments, if not outright falsehoods from President Biden. And it's not quite that absolutely no one knows about them at all, but they are definitely not the focus of attention in the way that they would have been in Washington in the 1990s or the aughts.
Yeah. He is. You know, I think people are being kind to Biden because remember, he greeted the pilgrims with Squanto when they came over. And so he's old and they're just cutting him a little bit of slack.
Catherine,
I think that's kind of nice. Bringing another, civility back to the press corps.
Another line let's say a pairing that I'm being the human ellipsis on from the speech is his commonly stated thing, which is resonant from the Obama administration, which he was a member, from what I understand. No one making less than $400,000 a year will pay a single solitary penny more in federal taxes. Nobody. Matt Welch ellipsis. Later on, he complains that Republicans are refusing to help out his plan to establish a minimum corporate tax rate of 15%. Can you explain to people, Catherine, how a minimum corporate tax rate of 15% does not square with, and I know this, I'm springing this on you, but you're the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, so I think that you might be able to handle this one, does not square with the no one making less than $400,000 a year will pay a single solitary penny more in federal taxes?
Yeah, so it's almost like maybe the people who actually write any specific check for a tax bill are not the only people who bear the burden of those taxes, for one thing. This actually gets back to what I was saying earlier about the tariffs. Again, Americans are right now, lots and lots of Americans are paying many pennies, tons of pennies of taxes, more than they were in the past because they have to pay more for goods. The same thing happens with corporate taxes, where they pass through in all kinds of ways to our economy. And of course, not all corporations are Elon Musk. Not every corporation is just like a cartoon billionaire that Joe Biden wants to punch in the face. That is always worth keeping in mind as well.
The term of art here is tax incidence, which is the sort of economist jargon for like not just who is charged the tax by the IRS, but who actually ends up paying more as the result of a tax. And most of the evidence finds that somewhere in the range of 50% of the corporate tax is actually paid for by labor, right? And so Joe Biden is out there saying, I'm the most labor-friendly president in history. We need blah, 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 unions, dirkader, jobs, 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 right? And
that was a direct quote, I think. That was, I remember that line.
Little bit of a summary. Please don't try and Google that and see where he said it.
Dirkader.
But Biden's pro-union stance is in some ways undermined by his push for a corporate tax increase, because that's who's going to end up paying it.
Okay. Nick, to follow up on your point about inflation and to crib one last bit from Joe Biden's AFL-CIO speech of last week, he said the following, and I would like to hear your take on what this says about Joe Biden's consistency in approaching the inflation question. Quote, look, the infrastructure law is about more than rebuilding our infrastructure. It's about rebuilding the middle class. And that's why we made sure that the infrastructure law included significant labor protections. For example, I insisted that the overwhelming majority of the funds included in the law are subject to Davis-Bacon requirements. Union has to do it. So folks, rebuilding our country will earn a prevailing wage. How does that square with the
Yeah,
fight
not
for,
very well at all, because
inflation.
One of the things that's going on, and this is, you know, the great thing about, you know, the whole history rhymes, it doesn't repeat thing, is that what we're witnessing now is near record low unemployment, which is driving up wages, which increases inflation. And then Biden is basically pouring some gasoline on top of that. By saying, oh, and by the way, every boondoggle project that I can manage to squeak through Congress before the Democrats get voted out in the fall, you're going to be paying top dollar on that. So this is not just a bad way of dealing with current inflation. It's kind of a way of locking it in for as long as possible. It's totally backwards.
So, Catherine, according to recent polling, just 21% of Americans think that Joe Biden should run again. And a plurality of Democrats who voted for him in 2020 said, nah, I'd be best maybe if he didn't do the whole running thing. And we know that you don't vote. You don't care about politics. You just care about your book club. But dare you, I don't know what that voice was, dare you speculate about... who do we think might, who do we think should, and who we think definitely should not run as president for the Democratic Party ticket in case Joe Robinette Biden doesn't run again?
Yeah, I want to thank the many, many podcast listeners who sent me the one news article about how Mitch Daniels was maybe going to get back into politics that appeared this week.
Oh, God.
I did. I asked for it. I was like, I know, I love him, but he's too old. He's never going to do it. And Peter Suderman, I think, was one of those people. But there were many, many people on many, many platforms who reached out to me to be like, eh? So I guess that's my might and should. But
that's a Democrat.
In the end, won't. I know that does not, he does not get to replace Joe Biden on the Democratic ticket. I just want to talk about Kamala Harris, who, like, the incredible extent.
Come on, we're not supposed to talk about it. That's what we were told at the Georgetown cocktail party, right?
The incredible extent to which she has lit this opportunity on fire. She was the VP for an aging bike fallen off, kind of not super reliable president who is also now an unpopular president in a recession. All she had to do was be adequate and then do one notably good thing. And I know that she was not set up to succeed, and I know there's all these other things going on, but she, that woman has to be laying awake every night being like, what happened and why am I not waltzing into this nomination? And thank God that she showed the world how much she sucks in time, because as we know from past reason coverage, Kamala is a cop.
I will just say that she showed her weaknesses in the primary right out of the gate, in particular on Medicare for All and sort of her inability to describe it in a way that was palatable even to the Democratic primary field, her kind of lack of deep knowledge, her just breezy, oh yeah, we'll just get rid of private insurance, it's bad, everybody hates it anyway, kind of comments there. And there is a reason that she flailed as a presidential primary candidate against Joe Biden, is because when she gets on the national stage, I think she has just significant weaknesses as a political candidate. And we are continuing to see that in her performance as vice president.
Nick, I feel like it's a old Yakov Smirnov, what a country type of thing. When you look at Kamala Harris's career, a country in which you could be so bad at politics and just continually get really good political jobs everywhere.
To keep it in California, Manuel, she's the Gene Mauck of presidential, would-be presidents.
Don't pick fights with me, Nicholas.
A demonstrated loser in both leagues who kept getting managerial posts and then would immediately fob it off on his underlings or his players when he sucked as a manager, Matt Welch.
Because I care about our listeners, I will let that vile wrongness stand.
Right. Thank you so much. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
I'm so mad about Gene Mauck and what he did to Richie, call me Dick Allen. And that's like only the beginning of it. How many other teams did he run?
Move on. Moveon.org, Nick.
It's funny. All right.
Two things.
No, I'm not.
Well,
okay.
All I was going to say is that watch out for Robinette, okay? Because at the start of 1983, a man named Ronnie Reagan had an approval rating of 40%, according to Gallup. Biden right now, and by the way, Reagan got wiped out in the midterms in 82. The Republicans lost like 25 seats. There was a recession going on, et cetera. He looked like a definite dumb old, monkey co-starring loser, one-termer. He ended up winning with, 50 states, and they just gave Minnesota to Walter Mondale because they were being nice. Yeah, Fritz Mondale, because Walter Mondale isn't an American enough name, so you want to go with Fritz. Biden, he started 1983 with a 35% approval rating. Biden is, according to Gallup, is at like 39.7. So don't count him out just yet.
Good sage advice. All right, we're gonna get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you tired of feeling like someone's always watching you on the internet, even when you think you're being discreet? Well, IPVanish VPN is here to protect your right to privacy and help you stay anonymous online. IPVanish enables you to browse safely without exposing your private information to third parties, whether they be advertisers, ISPs, hackers, or rooskies. When you use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, Fire Stick, all of your data is encrypted. That means all your private details, passwords, communications, browsing history, physical location will be completely shielded and without sacrificing your speed. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It really is that simple. Roundtable listeners who act now will receive an incredible 70% off their yearly plan, all with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's like getting 9 months for free, dude. Just go to ipvanish.com/roundtable. Use the promotional code Roundtable and take your privacy back right now. That's ipvanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder to send via email your terse queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Rion. How do you, R-I-O-N, Nick? How do you pronounce that? Whatever. It's Rion Duncan.
Mock. Gene Mock.
Who says a bunch of nice stuff before getting to the point. Here goes. Even though most, if not all of you, are resigned to the fate that will never see a libertarian president elected, those of you, and he used a small L there, those of you who do vote typically still vote for the capital L libertarian candidate, from what I gather. So my naively hypothetical question is, were a libertarian ever elected president, what realistic things would you like to see on their first 100 days agenda? The online libertarian crowd, of course, loves to post routinely about abolish the Fed, defund the CIA, disband the ATF, and much more. Still, in reality, not all libertarian wishes can be granted with the power of pen and phone. Rightly so, mind you. Even a well-intentioned, liberty-minded dictator is still a dictator. But there are things presidents can't do that would be incremental steps towards a society with more freedom. The first thing that comes to mind for me is using executive pardon capabilities for Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. That's timely. But the list certainly doesn't stop there. So I'm very interested to hear your libertarian presidential wish list ranging, I got to read this because it's good, ranging from complete anarchy, as KMW would have it, to Nick's likely entirely drug-related list, to Peter's statist apologist desires and cocktail party requirements, and even whatever baseball mandates and classic rock reforms Matt would request. There's no reason for reforms to classic rock, dudes. Catherine, start us off.
I'm hung up on classic rock reforms, too. Like, what would that even look like? What is that agenda? Right. So, you know, I actually think this question is really well put, because you can't, you know, this actually is a problem even with mainstream candidates, even with the two major parties. They have this huge list of stuff they're going to do in their first 100 days. And A, they never do it. And B, some of it is not appropriate to be done by the executive. And we recognize that. We're going to assume there was some kind of broad political sea change that got this libertarian elected. And so they have some support in the legislature as well. I don't know if that's a safe assumption or not, but there are things that a president can do right away that are well within the purview of the presidency. You know, I sometimes say when I am trying to summarize what Reason is about that we like or want to promote the free movement of people and goods across borders. And that is, for better or for worse, the president's business in a lot of ways. So I think that what, you know, a first 100 days libertarian president could do would be to sort of immediately liberalize a bunch of our immigration policies. Again, that is something that we are not going to cause new, different chaos to just start letting people in and offering them legal status. I think that that is something we could do very quickly. We could streamline it. We could do it within the bounds of kind of traditional law and order. Likewise with trade, we can simply undo a bunch of taxes that were going to be calculated on a quarterly or annual basis anyway. We can let corporations do the math in their own time, but we can change the rules right away. So that's where I would start. And again, the president is in charge of many, many massive bureaucracies. To start pruning those, to reduce the number of cabinet level departments and reports to the president, those are changes that are harder to undo. And so I like those two. And I think you could start those right away as well. Yes, the goal is anarchy, but as I said many times on this podcast, I don't want to see it all burn exactly. I want to do a controlled burn. I want to dig those little ditches and then burn little bits at a time, carefully, with a lot of firefighters standing by. Eventually, we burn it all down, but we don't just throw a match and hope.
Suderman, statist.
So I think there's two things that I would focus on, and one is very specific, and it's marijuana policy. And so a libertarian-leaning president could come in and say within the first 100 days they could lay out clearly in written guidance that they are not going to interfere with states. The Biden administration has kind of sort of done some of this a little bit by not really messing with states that have legalized pot. At the same time, the situation is kind of murky. There's still issues with pot entrepreneurs in states where it's legalized, getting involved in banking, that sort of thing. And there's still some sort of legal lack of clarity there. And the a president could deprioritize enforcement and make clear that they are not going to go after people who are operating legally inside states. And that's something they could do quite quickly within the first 100 days. But the other thing that I would say is I would like to see a president, and this is probably, I'm probably the only person who's like, man, this is really important, who focuses on agency staffing. And agency staffing is the biggest thing the president, it's not just that they can do, it's that they have to do it, right? And they have to, and this is something that like every president comes in, they have all these political appointees, and they have all these people who are running big federal agencies that are governed by statute, but are sort of, but that are projects of the president in a lot of ways, right? That are run through the Oval Office. And a libertarian-leaning president could come up with a list of here's who I would like to appoint to specific agencies. Here are people who have clear plans that they have outlined, that they have like put out in public and said, look, this is how we are going to, this is how we're going to run these agencies. This is how the, you know, the types of things that we plan to do and that we are going to do less and that we are going to, you know, sort of do, that we are going to make things more free for the types of businesses and activities that we regulate. And, you know, you can think of someone like Ajit Pai, who is a little bit along these lines, someone like Scott Gottlieb, who was at the FDA. I think, you know, some we might have some arguments with the way he ran the FDA, but he has a pretty clear CDC reform plan that he's outlined. A lot of elements, maybe not all, but many elements of which I think are pretty salutary. And relatedly, I would say that in the staffing process, I would prioritize not only people who have clearly articulated reform plans, but people who have plans to reduce the headcount of the federal workforce and to say up front that what we want is 10% or 5% or whatever the number is, to come up with an achievable number of federal workers that you no longer want to, that like you're going to have a, you are going to have fewer bureaucrats working in Washington. And that would be that I think would be somewhat harder to undo, and it would make a difference to the budget, and it would make it harder for a Democratic administration, say, that followed and wanted to sort of increase regulation. They would have to go out and hire a bunch more people and get money for it and all that stuff. And so it would slow down the bureaucracy and sort of the bureaucratic works in a way that I think could be productive, wouldn't, you know, set things on fire, would make a lot of people mad for sure, but is actually achievable.
Nick, you know, I like the idea that the letter writer put in there about, I was going to say, you know, pardoning or, you know, or ending, you know, the sentences of people in federal prison who don't deserve to be there. But I think, you know, he could also balance that by putting Gene Mauck, who, you know, wouldn't really care, right, if he was denounced by the president at this late state in his life, yes, as an underground. But maybe he could be reburied on Alcatraz Island or something like that. No, but I would love to see the president come in with a long list of people that he is going to pardon or commute their sentences, and use that in order to kind of, you know, signal what are his priorities. And so that would include pardoning or, you know, people like Assange or Snowden, you know, Ross Ulbricht in the past, people like Lenny Bruce or Jack Johnson, the boxer and whatnot, people historically who had been, you know, found guilty or charged with certain types of crimes. I would love to see a president come in and say, you know, as part of his campaign, really, these are the priorities, and this is how I'm going to start moving forward in a government that spends less and does less, but is also focused on actual justice to people, you know, currently suffering as well as in the past, but then also here are the ways in which we're going to go forward.
So my answers to the question are obviously immediately open up the UFO files and the JFK files just to make everyone go crazy for a while. And while everyone's going crazy, do stuff like stop war is an idea. President has an incredible amount of authority to wage wars, including open-ended wars since September 11th. We've been operating under an authorization for the use of military force since September 14th, 2001. And using that just to drone people in random countries, stop doing that. You have the authority to not be droning people to death in countries with which we are not at war, and to even to recognize out loud that that's against the letter of and certainly spirit of the War Powers Resolution or whatever it's called specifically. So stop doing that. Start the process of discussing first in NATO and Europe about making NATO a European organization that America, you know, says hi to on occasion. And then secondly, on start similar conversations with Japan and South Korea and start handing off responsibility for the world's affairs to the people whose lives it affects and who can pay for it themselves. That's the beginning of a process. Can't just do that one overnight. But what you can do overnight is close Guantanamo Bay, for crying out loud. You can publicize the budgets of the CIA and other secret parts of government who have been acting without any sense of accountability forever and just lying about the stuff that they do. You could do all that stuff. Incredible amounts of power. Use it. In that way to add more sunlight on this day of solstice and stop the killing of the people.
There is no more sunlight possible. I like that your answer was just the meme where you were like, if I was president, I would simply not do war. Like, that's a good answer. That is like an excellent answer.
I mean, like, it's I'm like when it's time for war, I'm all for the war. But We've been warring on autopilot with very little authorization, and it's awful. And we just sort of take it for granted, and we shouldn't. We shouldn't be droning people to death in faraway countries. Stop it. Okay. So we have a little bit of time left before we go to our end of a show segment. So let's do a quick lightning round. The Supreme Court in the next 2 weeks is going to finish its school year. With big decisions coming down, could be as soon as Tuesday or Thursday of this week or next week, especially about the Dobbs abortion decision, which is likely to overturn Roe versus Wade. We have talked about the specifics of that case in the past, and we will talk about the specifics of that decision in the future without a doubt. But I wanted to just sort of like tease up ahead of time the way that we're kind of dealing with and talking about the use and the threat of kind of violence and intimidation on this question. Kath, let's start with you. Just sort of in your sense of polarization and the kind of normalization or not of of violence in American society right now and politics, how worried are you about the possibility of intimidation of justices, of violence, not just against abortion providers, but anti-abortion activists, or just of the law itself, you know, theoretically doing violence against pregnant women? Are there ways that we can kind of take down the political temperature, or are we doomed?
Yeah, I mean, I would say my primary worry is, in fact, that the court will pave the way for states to do state-sanctioned legal violence against women doing something that was mere days or weeks before completely legal and should be, in my view, completely legal. We are going to see a bunch of law enforcement agents suddenly tasked, because we do have these trigger laws, right? There are a bunch of states where as soon as the court decides, the law changes. And so we're going to see a bunch of law enforcement agents tasked with enforcing something that is, they're going to have to relearn how to do it, and they're going to screw it up bad. Oh, are they going to screw it up bad? We're going to end up with women who had miscarriages hauled in wrongly. We're going to end up with women seeking different types of obstetrical and gynecological care hauled in wrongly. And we're going to end up with women who were seeking abortions, in fact, hauled in wrongly because it is wrong to criminalize abortion, in my view. So it is going to be a very, very challenging moment for law enforcement in those states with trigger laws in particular. And I have no faith at all that anyone has trained these law enforcement agents on what to do. And so I worry for everyone in that equation. That when you throw someone with a gun and with the state-sanctioned monopoly on violence into these interactions, it generally doesn't improve them.
Suderman, you live in Washington. Is it just going to be open season on judges from now on outside their houses?
Well, I think the protest environment is not going to go away soon. I certainly can imagine that extending well, you know, throughout the summer and perhaps even into next year, although at some point those things do tend to sort of fade out. It is hard for me to believe that, like, there is an argument that eliminating Roe will just send this back to states and decentralize and defederalize the issue. In some ways, that is true, because it does affect, like ending Roe doesn't make abortion illegal. It makes the question of whether of abortion's legality up to the states. At the same time, abortion has been a federal issue for so long and is such a powerful political force in federal politics that it is just hard for me to imagine a scenario in which abortion politics, protests, rallies, speeches, you know, just sort of random remarks on the House or Senate floor, statements from the president or from people who would like to be president are not part of our politics, at least for several years going forward.
Nick, where's your sense of anxiety about the question of violence and abortion politics right now?
You know, it's deeply worrying because we've seen some violence or attempts at violence recently. Historically, it's been anti-abortion forces that have been more violent than pro-choice. And you can go back to, you know, violent protests in places like Buffalo, where an abortion provider was actually killed in his home. Similar things happened in Kansas. People like Eric Rudolph, the great atheist bomber, anti-abortion bomber of the 1996 Atlanta game. But I, you know, one of the things that is striking is that we thought that violence in American politics had really been reduced over the past several decades. It seems to be coming back in a way. So I think it's very, very deeply troubling. I don't know, you know, what's going to happen. And it's, you know, I agree with Catherine that there's probably going to be a lot of really bad acting by both, you know, local, state and federal police. As if in fact abortion laws, the right to an abortion gets removed by the Supreme Court, you're going to see a lot of states act a lot of different ways. So, you know, I'd say you got to be on high alert about all this stuff.
All right, let's get to our end of podcast. What we have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Peter, you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I've been watching Obi-Wan Kenobi, the latest Star Wars miniseries on Disney Plus, and it is... it's okay. It's just okay. And sort of disappointingly just okay. So there's a bunch of things that work pretty well, including and especially Ewan McGregor's performance as an old, sad, broken Jedi Master. He's got a great beard. The beard is so good. There are some nice visuals, including this this big, crazy black triangle sea base that all the bad guys operate out of. And it is nice to see Star Wars trying, if somewhat haltingly, to move beyond Tatooine, where they keep returning, which is sort of like it's actually sort of weird. Like the Star Wars universe is supposed to be this big intergalactic empire, and yet half the stories seem to be set on this like kind of random sand planet that like is established at the very beginning of the series as being way out from the center and not really all that important, except actually it's super important. And there's like a good grain of an idea here in that it establishes the backstory for why Leia in the very first Star Wars says, "Obi-Wan, you're my only hope." It's because she and Obi-Wan had an adventure together when she was young. And so she learned to trust him and his abilities there. But the whole thing just sort of seems kind of underthought, half-baked. In particular, the use of Darth Vader, who is back. They've even brought. I'm now just gonna
Hayden Christensen. His
name. What is this guy's? They brought Hayden Christensen back.
Did your mind erase Hayden Christensen?
Yes.
Was your
Gene
mind
Hawk
like
is a Tusken Raider?
No.
Perhaps.
Yes. They brought Hayden Christensen back, right? And Hayden Christensen gets just one or two scenes as like a CG de-aged version of himself so that he looks like he did 20 years ago. But more than any other character in the Star Wars universe, Darth Vader is like the heart of the thing, right? There's a way in which the whole story is actually Vader's story, or at least that Vader is like the most compelling character, the one you always come back for. And they're using him again, and they're not using him all that well. Like, it's a great character, and he always sort of works well enough, but they're not using him all that well or doing all that much with the character. And so in some ways, I feel like they're sort of spending down the mystery and the wonder of Darth Vader and the ways in which part of what made him so compelling was that he was, in some sense, a mystery. There was this sort of weird kind of evil darkness to him that was unexplained. And now we're getting a lot of explanation for Darth Vader, and I don't think it completely works.
I can testify from my weekend's activities of watching the second half of the second trilogy with my 13-year-old, that generation, just like Robbie Suave, that's where they live. Hayden Christensen, bad emo boy, smoldering eyes, terrible dialogue. It just works. They love it.
The rat tail and the mullet.
Holy cow, the rat tail. It all works terribly well. Nick, what Gene Mock biographies did you read?
You know what I read, instead of reading anything about Gene Mock, I read Brian Doherty, Reason's own Brian Doherty's Woo-hoo! Dirty Pictures, How an Underground Network of Nerds, Feminists, Misfits, Geniuses, Bikers, Potheads, Printers, Intellectuals, and Art School Rebels revolutionized art and invented comics with an X, meaning underground comics.
I thought our subtitle was it on the long side.
I'm sure if it's true to form, they probably cut Brian's preferred subhead in a third. It's an excellent book about underground comics. You know, think people like Robert Crumb, Trina Robbins, Art Spiegelman, and that entire movement, which is adjacent to things like beatnik culture, hippie culture, rock music, punk eventually. It's just a really great flowering of a post-war moment where individual expression became the norm. And what is it? I mean, so it's fascinating whether you care about underground comics, whether you care about the Furry Freak Brothers, which, by the way, is a great cartoon that has been animated as on, you can watch it on Tubi, T-U-B-I, the free streaming service. There's like two seasons of Furry Freak Brothers animated shorts who are just idiot stoners. But it's a fantastic body of work to look at. You know, Mouse, Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer Prize winning, National Book Award winning, epic version of his father's Holocaust experiences is probably the high watermark of underground comics. But the entire book is fantastic if you care about that stuff. But then more broadly, if you wonder about the world of just massively proliferating cornucopia-like offerings of cultural individualized expression, underground comics play a huge role in it. It's just fantastic. A really good book, Dirty Pictures, How blah, blah, blah revolutionized art and invented comics. It's a great read. Also, if you're in the New York City area, come to Caveat Theater at 6 p.m. tonight. We are letting everybody in because this is a Reason Speakeasy for the people, Matt Welch. And so you don't even have to buy a ticket ahead of time. Go to reason.com/events for details, but just show up at the door and you'll be able to hear Brian Doherty talk at length. Maybe he'll even get through part of his preferred subhead before we run out of time.
Wow. That's great. Shout out to B-Do. Catherine?
Yeah, his book, I just want a second. The book is really good. And also I have Brian Doherty to thank for my initial exposure to this whole genre, which was a Reason piece in 2010 where he touted R. Crumb's version of Genesis, which it's the biblical Genesis story, not changed, just illustrated by R. Crumb. And if you ever just want to take a moment to grapple with how incredibly messed up that is as a narrative, as a story, as theoretically the foundation of numerous world religions, wow, it's messed up, man, said the atheist who has no belief in the sanctity of things. I'm going to recommend, in addition to Brian's book, I'm going to recommend a podcast that I recently started listening to. It's called Normal Gossip. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It is just a podcast where people get on. The second season started recently. The host is Kelsey McKinney. And people just get on and gossip about someone you don't know. Like, they just bring some high quality, juicy gossip about a normal person. And they just unspool it for you. There's a little choose your own adventure vibe. It's like, what would you do next? And then you find out what they did next. And they bring on a guest to just like hash out the gossip. That's it. And I've realized that like a lot of the appeal of even podcasts like ours is that you're just kind of like buddies. You're a little invested in some of the story arcs. You just want to know what's what. And sometimes you don't want it to be about Chinese tariff exclusions. Sometimes you just want the dirt. And this podcast really delivers on that. It's a very, very high quality version of when your friend just like fills you in on the stuff that's going on with their coworkers that you've gotten a little too invested in. And I love it. I am guessing that this is gendered and that this is a podcast mostly for ladies. But honestly, I'm going to recommend it to our gentlemen listeners, along with the ladies who are out there.
The few gentlemen listeners gossip. Of this podcast.
There's a lot of men who listen. I don't know.
Well, is this like Prairie gentlemen? Home Companion, but with gossip? Is it like Matt Welch had an extra slice
it's not
of pie?
Cutesy.
You know?
No, it's not cutesy at all.
I don't know what
all.
His
it's
wife
really
is
just,
feeding him these days, but...
There are no ads for Ivory you know. Soap flakes. There's okay. none of that. It's just, it's really, truly just in a perfect conversational tone.
I spent the weekend, among other activities, celebrating the 80th birthday of Paul McCartney, Nick's very favorite Beatle. I'm just glad to see that the kid is finally getting the respect that he deserves after his years in the music biz. Two bits that I would recommend everyone. And again, my preface to everything is no one ever needs to read or hear or see or do anything even 1 second more about the Beatles. But for those of you who do like that stuff, two things. One, Sean Lennon did an incredible little video of Here, There, and Everywhere. Sean Lennon, who's a very gifted recording artist, a musician, studio guy. Just him playing it carries all kinds of emotional significance, but also it's just a really incredibly hard song to play. A guy who's got that many chops just trying to like get this seemingly simple, very complicated composition played out is really kind of neat to watch. But especially, and Nick kind of even referred to this, at least in our pregame chat or maybe on the show, Stereo Gum had a piece over the weekend called 80 Artists Pick Their Favorite Paul McCartney Song for His 80th Birthday. It is 80,000 trillion words long. If you're going to read it, pack a picnic lunch. You would expect your Elvis Costellos. I like the bits from Steve Earle, Richard Thompson. Thank God someone stood up for Penny
his
Lane.
Lights, Matt Welch.
Well, it's very heavy on the people picking semi-obscure tracks like Temporary Secretary and Waterfalls off his great McCartney 2 kind of stoner techno record from 1980-ish. And so there isn't a whole lot of Live and Let Die.
There was kind of Live and Let Die. Who somebody did name Live and Let Die.
We did have one. Okay, but yeah. But anyways, it's fascinating to read how other artists deal with it. How some of them are trying to outfancy one another. Telling so many people have personal stories either with him or just how that at some point their life was galvanized, particularly by watching the Ed Sullivan Show or some other performance. And, they had their band. It's just a very interesting read if you're into that kind of stuff. So Stereo Gum, 80 Artists, pick
Matt,
your favorite.
Matt, what Paul is McCartney your, you know, I want to add two things to this. First is there's a great book from the 80s, I guess, maybe late 70s, called Growing Up with the Beatles, where the author who lived in Kansas City, and there's a bunch of Kansas City Royals stuff going on there, Matt, just to keep you happy for a second. But at one point, he is growing up, and he just explains how every major milestone, milestone of his life, there was some Beatles presence. And I remember him talking about how his father gave him the Facts of Life speech to Fool on the Hill was playing in the background.
Oh,
which
wow.
is very That's disturbing. What is your favorite Macca song?
My answer to all such questions comes with a preamble of that all favorite songs are subject to change in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. But the one that I love right now is the long version of With a Little Luck, which is
God.
Sort of a forgotten late 70s bit. But listen to it with a Vangelis Blade Runner kind of vision in your mind, and it'll sound kind of different and weird. He came out, I think, in 78, and it's...
I just heard some words.
Yeah,
Vangelis. Vangelis.
Aaron and I both woke up for Blade Runner.
It's got a super Blade Runner
I'm pretty sure
vibe,
and Roy Batty is humming that throughout Blade Runner, I think.
Yeah.
In the director's... In the super director's cut, He originally said, with a little luck... But then they were like, hey, why don't you go with Time to Die?
I'm always interested, since McCartney's kind of a controversially, you know, banal lyricist. Like when he chooses to express emotion is very strange. And at the end of With a Little Luck is some of his most emotional vocals ever. It's like, why? What are you doing?
I think
like,
curses.
Why this song?
Doesn't he curse for AM radio? He throws a damn in there or something like that? Or
it can make the whole damn thing work
yeah.
out.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his songs that are light on lyrics, but are super emotional. So I was thinking, My Love, Maybe I'm Amazed, and Hey Jude, Matt, where the lyrics are beside the point, but there's so much kind of universal kind of love feeling going on in the music and the way he performs, even if the lyrics are kind of banal. That's for me.
Nile Rodgers in the Stereo Gum piece chooses Maybe I'm Amazed, and his treatment of that actually makes, or his discussion of it makes me think about the song differently than I had before. So that's one of the many reasons to read that. Okay. Thank you for listening. If you like our podcasts, go to reason.com/podcasts. And oh my garden, we've got a new one, kids, coming out Friday. Drum roll, please. The Reason Rundown with Peter Suderman. Peter, tell us about your new exciting venture.
The Reason Rundown is a podcast to finish out your week. So every week, I will talk to a single Reason staffer about a single topic, often drawing on a larger, longer piece that they have worked on. So I'm so lucky to have so many great colleagues and to learn from them all the time. And the goal here with the Rundown is to showcase not only some of Reason's best work, but also to show off our many, many excellent staffers and just how fascinating they are. Right now, you can obviously hear from the four of us every week with occasional guest appearances, and obviously, I love all of my colleagues on the roundtable here, but those guest appearances are also really great, and I wanted to do more with them and with those people. We just have so many smart and interesting, eclectic, neat folks on staff, all of whom have wide-ranging knowledge about a huge array of topics. So I wanted to bring those personalities and that knowledge to Reason listeners in podcast form. Here's the other thing about this podcast. It's not going to be really long, about 20 or 25 minutes per episode, which I think is just right to get to know someone and to get to know what you know, an issue or a story that they've worked on. So this is a place to get to hear from Stephanie Slade on the rise of illiberalism or Christian Britschke on how crazy zoning rules ruin everything. CJ Ciaramarella on weird outrages related to asset forfeiture or Liz Wolf on cryptocurrency and the politics of the tech business. We just have so many great folks on staff, and this is a place where you're going to get to know them and their beats. I think of this a little bit as speed dating Reason staffers and their issues.
No. God, no.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy.
I mean, yes, but also very much
no.
But in podcast form. So again, it's called The Reason Rundown, and it's coming soon.
Who's up first? Do you know?
We don't, and you'll find out Friday.
Wow.
My God, I don't think I can wait.
Better get one in the can, Suderman. All right. Thank you, everyone. And if you want to encourage us to do more stuff like this, a great way to do it is give us all your money. So reason.com/donate. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and it helps us do more stuff in the world. Okay. Thanks. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.